Hey there, Lissa DeHart here. Welcome to the Coaching Studio, the podcast that introduces you to real coaches and those making a real positive impact in professional coaching. Let's go. Hello, I'm Lissa DeHart, the host of the Coaching Studio on this final episode of season three. Season four starts in the fall, so please come back. And thank you to all the listeners who have supported this podcast over the last couple of years. Today, it is my pleasure to introduce you to David Franklin. He is a MCC with the International Coaching Federation. He is also an executive leadership and personal coach with over 25 years of experience. He holds a master's degree in leadership and organizational development. And along with his work as a coach, he is also a leadership and organizational development consultant, trainer, and facilitator. And along the way, David has discovered a passion for mentoring other coaches. David originally hails from New York. That said, he has lived in the Pacific Northwest for over 30 years and, in fact, is actually a neighbor of mine. Beyond being a coach, David is a classical guitarist who spends time listening to a lot of heavy metal. He is an outdoor enthusiast with a special affinity for hiking and birding by ear. Yeah, we're going to hear a little bit more about that. He's an avid traveler. He is a bagel and pizza snob, married to a lovely personal chef, and the father to an aspiring rock guitarist and songwriter. David, welcome to the Coaching Studio.
Thanks, Lissa. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I love your guitars in the background. It speaks to the classical guitar and a little of the heavy metal. If I'm looking at the two of them sort of to the, I guess, left of the, or the right of your head, but the left of the more classical guitar. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely a guitar is I've been playing since I was 15. So definitely something I'm still passionate about.
That is so cool. So, you know how I start the show, really kind of exploring the journeys that people have taken to get from sort of classical guitar at 15 to master certified coach working in the executive and leadership realm, you know, years later. Were there some like little spots that were particularly important in the navigation of your life towards this moment?
I mean, there's probably a lot of them. It's in a way, it's like, I always think of I'm not really a planner overall. Like I more kind of trust the process and just see where it takes me. And so I often don't set out with a plan per se, but I guess some turning points were, I was in an alternative program my senior year of high school. I went to a college that was very non-traditional here in Washington, the Evergreen State College. And I was very much into kind of non-traditional education and more experiential, more holistic, more systems-focused approach to things. And so I think that kind of opened my mind to different possibilities and ways that not only ways that I could work, but just ways to see the world in general. And so part of that journey involved doing a lot of personal growth work as well and realizing, I need to be the change, as Gandhi says, and I need to ultimately, as I started realizing I wanted to have impact, like I have to do the work myself first. And so I did a lot of personal growth workshops, and actually that kind of led me to my first dip into coaching, or kind of initiation in coaching was, I was participating in some personal growth workshops in New York, where I'm from, and I was back home after college. And as well as actually, I would go home and take some of them during college. But anyway, the person who led these workshops, he was a psychotherapist turned coach, and there was something in the way that he facilitated and led and kind of guided everyone through, and his insights and the questions he would ask. Like, I was always in awe, like, that's amazing. Like, he was just so able to kind of get to it, quickly, deeply, powerfully. And I experienced a lot of, you know, big transformation, you know, in that process. And then I came to find out, so my mom is also a coach, incidentally. And incidentally, she and I were also both trained at the same time because we were both participating in these programs. And she was like, oh, he's going to be training people how to do what he does, essentially. Like, are you interested? And I was like, yeah. So we both did it at the same time. And that was kind of my intro into coaching. And then things started to, you know, I think I realized around that time that I just really wanted to be in some type of helping profession. Like I wanted to be able to help other people be the best selves they can be. And I think it started off on that personal journey. And, you know, without getting too long-winded, eventually that started to blossom more into realizing I wanted to have a larger scale impact than just individuals and kind of like small groups, but how could I have greater impact? And I realized, oh, organizations are like built-in communities of people who, you know, are, you know, I don't want to say they're forced to work together, but they're bound to work together. They're interdependent in terms of the success of the organization. And so while the byproduct of the organization is, you know, especially if I believe in the organization is great, even more is like helping people establish a culture and a way of being with each other that's much more transformational, that's much more fulfilling and meaningful, where people actually have a sense of joy and fulfillment and purpose. And so how can I create that on a large scale? And I was like, that's a place where I can bring a lot of these skills to support that.
Well, you have brought up several things I want to go back to. So one, a common theme that I hear, and honestly, I think it's a common theme because it's so incredibly true, which is the work has to start with ourselves. And I'm just really thinking about this kid, I'm assuming you're a kid when you're going to Evergreen, and you're already starting this exploration of yourself. What do you think? I mean, I know you had sort of non-traditional schooling going into college, and then college was sort of a non-traditional kind of experience at Evergreen. I think that's common for people who go to Evergreen, from what I've heard. But like, what allowed, do you think, you to really be able to turn that lens on yourself at such a young age? And I'm just going to stop there.
Well, I'll go back even younger because I had a lot of family issues growing up. And I also had a lot of social issues growing up. And it really took a turn when I was in seventh grade. It was a really bad year for me in a lot of ways. And I actually started to develop a really severe stutter. I was to the point where it was hard for me to finish sentences. It was hard for me to start sentences. I mean, all of a sudden it kind of kicked in. And so I went to therapy. And so I was about 12 or so. And so I think at that point, I think I was always open to learning, and I've always been very curious in general, and that extends to myself, you know, as part of the, as you know, someone who's here and in this world. And so I think
it is your longest relationship after all.
That's true. That's true. So I think just, you know, being in therapy was, I think, a start on that path of self-exploration and discovery. And I really love the process. I mean, I it was very helpful for me. I was fortunate to actually have a good therapist, which is often uncommon. I think from my experience, it's hard to find a good therapist. And he was not only good, he was good for me. And he really helped me work past a lot of things and through a lot of things. And so as a result, my stutter got a lot better. And but I also just, I think, became a more fulfilled person and in a lot of ways. And so I think that kind of opened me up then to pursue more things like that. And I think also another thing that happened at Evergreen, which was also has been a big part of my journey, is I joined a men's group. And I was fortunate enough, like through my you know, my program in high school and meeting people and developing friendships, where, you know, one of my friends was like, oh, I just joined a men's group and we're doing these things. I'm like, that sounds really cool. I want to do that. And he lived somewhere else. So I was like, I'm going to find one. And
there's got to be one here.
Yeah. And so I ended up joining a men's group. And then that became a huge part of my coaching practice and a huge part of my journey for many years, was really focusing a lot on men and men's work.
And I definitely want to come back to that, because I know your book is really, in some ways, based on what I was reading, is about some of that journey of empowered mask. I don't know what you would call it, empowering the masculine in a really healthy way, was what I kind of was gathering. It's so funny too. when I was in graduate school, I joined a group because I decided, you know, I needed to do therapy on my own terms. And so I decided I was going to join an empowerment group, and I sign up for it, and it ends up being led by a man and only men in it and me. And it was a gestalt group. So I ended up playing the role of every possible, the ex-girlfriend, the ex-wife, the new, like the mom, the sister, the whatever, the child. It was hilarious. But it was, it for me, like you, it was this opportunity to really do a lot of deep reflection and really figure out a lot of things about my relationship with not just myself, but also with ideas of relationships with other people. And yeah. I mean, I think it definitely impacted the work that I'm doing. And so I really appreciate hearing how you did that, because I think that idea that we hold space more with more integrity, with more capacity when we've held that space for ourselves is really crucial. And I love that you're speaking to that.
Yeah, in so many ways. I mean, and I'm sure at some point we'll talk more about, you know, coaching and, you know, coaching approaches. But to me, like the one thing when I'm mentoring people that I come back to when people are like, what's the thing I can most do to be a better coach, or how can I get better? Like the thing I always say, the most important thing you can do is work on yourself. Like do your own work, like deal with your stuff, like get it out of the way so that you can be fully present with someone. And as much as we can, like, to mitigate our biases, to be able to listen deeply and not be projecting our own stuff onto the client. So we're not being reactive or triggered, or being able to deal with our reactions if the client brings something up that's maybe hard or confusing, or being able to be spontaneous and adaptable in the moment when maybe we don't know where to go or how to proceed, and we don't want to, you know, start to get in our heads. And so, I mean, all those things, like doing our personal work, is to me the most fundamental thing you can do as a coach. And if you don't do that, and I see this in other helping practitioners, therapists, or whoever, mm-hmm. if you don't do that, I don't care how many degrees you have or how much theory you know, you will not be that effective.
Yeah. Honestly, it's sort of interesting too, because I mean, I got a master's in social work, and I don't know how many people in my program were in their own form of therapy. I don't think that many, and it wasn't a requirement. And that's one of the things that I've always really appreciated in coaching, is that one of the things that coaches do is they end up getting a lot of coaching because they're doing lots of like peer coaching and practicing. And so there's sort of this sort of built-in opportunity for reflection that happens through the coaching training process, which I think, honestly, now my mother went through, like, her PhD was in psychology, and so, and Jungian psychology specifically, and she was in all, like, that was required. So it's not that all therapists are not required to go through some process, but a lot are not. You know, a lot of schools do not say this is a requirement. And while I don't know that coaching schools say it's a requirement, the fact is you get it sort of anyway, because you're practicing with your friends and your cohort and all of that. So you end up getting that opportunity to do that self-reflective process and be in the other seat, not just the helping seat.
Yeah. And I would say the, kind of like the yes and would be, I think coaches have to be willing to even go beyond that, to, like, you know, even beyond the, yes. the coaching approach, to realize there's, you know, because I think there's things in a coaching set you're not necessarily going to focus on your family of origin or your culture of origin or right. some of those things that are also, you know, really important for us to understand and know about ourselves. And so it, yeah. it has to be like, yes, that's definitely a way that we do get it. And yet we have to go deeper and say, like, okay, how can I really continually be working on my stuff and seeing who I am and how I came to be the way I am and be able to be my best self and also accept the imperfections in ways that I'm not always going to be my best self.
Yes. To quote Brené Brown, the gifts of imperfection, and really not just say it as like a euphemism, but actually, like, I'm okay. working on it so that I can be okay with the fact that I'm not perfect. And, yeah. and I really also, I think that piece is really key about how we get triggered, because it's so easy to fall into the shadow of shame or whatever our narrative is about what it is that we're hearing, whether we're the coach or the client, the coach mentor or the coach mentor client, however we say that. I just really struggle with the word mentee, but anyway, you know, how we hear things and how that impacts our capacity to grow and learn and develop ourselves. And so I really appreciate that you brought that forward. The other thing that you brought forward that I think is like, now I'm really curious is who was your coach training with? Because it sounds like it was really at the cusp of the coaching movement. It sounds like a really interesting person you were trained with. Who were you training with?
Yeah. So it was, his name is Tony Kirkland or Eugene Kirkland. And he had a school called Pathways. I don't know. And by school, it was very like, you know, informal kind of, it wasn't, well, I mean, this was in 96. So, I mean,
no browser yet.
Exactly. So it wasn't necessarily as formal as, let's say, you know, something like, you know, some of the current coach training programs that are very, so it was definitely much more kind of raw so basically he led, I don't know how many, you know, how many, coach training programs or cohorts or whatever he did on, I haven't spoken to him in quite a number of years, so I'm not sure what he's up to, or I think at one point he was living in South Africa, so I'm not sure where he is or what he's up to, but he definitely was. I mean, I think I was really fortunate to get hit, and I think the thing I appreciated as well is that in his approach, it was very much, it's funny because it does align to a lot of the things that have started to emerge more recently in coaching. For example, coaching the person, not the problem, was something that he was very much part of that paradigm versus, okay, like go take some action, some transactional actions, or, you know, have some transactional changes and, you know, get stuff done and accomplish mm-hmm. it, which is what a lot of the earlier coaching was about, more transactional yeah. versus transformational. But he was very, and I think having the therapy background for him. So we kind of, I think of, in a way, our style of coaching is, I'd say, you know, it's definitely very much coaching, but it has enough of the therapeutic elements that it goes deep. So I'd mm-hmm. say it's more deep coaching versus, you know, some of the, like I said, transactional or kind of superficial type of focus. Yeah. So without crossing the line. And yeah. that's the thing I appreciated about his approach.
Well, and it's an interesting line too, because I mean, I hear from people, this is kind of my funny thing lately. People try and summarize the difference between coaching and therapy all the time, you know, and so I've heard a myriad of things and I'm sure they're changing. But one of the things that I often hear is, you know, coaching is for the present, therapy is for the past. And I always laugh because I'm like, well, when did we start this conversation? I mean, technically, in the past, right? So, and the weird thing is, even if we're talking about a meeting that went really horrible last week, as soon as we start talking about it in this moment, it is now in the present. And so how do you start to discern? And I'm curious what your thoughts are on like this discernment of like past, present, deep therapy, coaching. That's a lot. And I just threw it at you, David. So hot potato.
Definitely unpack that. And also, I think something I get asked a lot, and this comes up in the mentoring, is like, you know, how do you differentiate? How do you make sure you're not crossing a line that, you know, mm-hmm. as a coach, or, you know, where is that line? And I think, you know, people are feel like, oh, if we go into emotions and stuff like that, it's going to be, you know, we're going into therapy, which is not the case. But it's more, you know, ultimately, like what determines whether it's coaching or therapy is our approach and how we show up. Am I showing up as coach or am I showing up as therapist? And I think about it in terms of maybe the tie into the past is, I see therapy as being more trauma focused, like something happened and we just cannot get past it for whatever reason. And it's maybe impacting our relationships or our work or our health or whatever it is, but at some level of trauma that, that needs healing. There's something that more needs to be healed. And I see coaching as more about an opportunity for kind of transformation and growth. And of course, it's not exclusive there. Of course, there's growth and healing. But so I'd say it's more, who do I want to become, and being at a place where I have the inner resources to become that. And so one of the differentiators in working with someone of like, okay, is coaching right for them or is therapy, is there kind of a persistent pattern or theme that just like You know, maybe we talk about something and we've talked about it now for five sessions and they're not making progress, or they just can't take action. There's something mm-hmm. that's really keeping them from moving forward. There's probably something there that's more deep seated that just mm-hmm. is going to be more conducive to therapy. And it will be more like a talking and processing. And coaching, I think, is more, I hate to say action oriented, because one of the things I also avoid when I'm mentoring is like, coaching is not about taking action. It's about increasing awareness to be able to make the choices that we want to make. And so, and I think where coaches get stuck is they get future focused and they get action focused, and that actually gets in the way of the client. So I would say those are some elements that I consider in terms of like how you differentiate and where some of those lines are.
I'm in an alignment with a couple of things, well, with many of the things that you said, but a couple of things that this idea, I remember hearing a therapist at a training that I was in back in probably the early 2000s. And they were saying, you know, really the role of a therapist is to get somebody from dysfunction to functional. Yeah. Right. That's really it. So there's, whether it's the trauma, whatever the trauma is, and it tends to be some sort of trauma that we've experienced, is to go from dysfunctional to functional. And I like what you said, because I really see coaching as that movement from functional to whatever's next, like whatever that, and I think of it as more like directionality. So like, if I know what your direction is that you want to go, talking about the anxiety or the emotions or even the past trauma is all safe within the window of what is it served for, what you want in the direction you want to be going, versus let's go back and let me teach you all these skills and work on you and developing all these ways of self-managing yourself because you're not functional yet. Like, and that's where I think people, at least from my experience, step into doing not only bad therapy, but also bad coaching at that moment.
And to me, I think the guiding, the guiding principles, I think it's helpful now having the ICF competencies, because ultimately, if we just stick to those competencies, we are, to me, I mean, those a lot, you know, we're not necessarily processing if we're using those competencies. We're not giving advice. We're not giving direction. We're not, you know, kind of telling, hey, try this or explore that. Like, and I think there can be, I think sometimes in therapy, and again, maybe there's a line here where it's like, sure, the client in therapy should have an agenda and should be able to have agency over what happens. But at the same time, there may be something where the therapist may need to be more directive because there's something to be able to get to that the client may not be able to, they may not know what they don't know in a way that could keep them from, you know, being able to kind of tap into certain things. Whereas I think in coaching, people are more at a place where they can choose and have more of a sense of kind of what's needed or where they want to go or have that differentiation. Yeah. So I think that makes it a little easier in that regard. But to me, when I'm, again, it's like if we have really aligned to those ICF competencies and are practicing that, and that's the same for, this is opening another direction, but people are, how do I know if I'm successful as a coach? And they base their success on the client's outcomes. But there's only so much control we have over what a client does or doesn't do and what choices they want to make. And so to me, the measure of a good coach is, am I practicing the ICF competencies to the best of my ability in a way that's totally skillful, that I can go back and self-reflect and say, I could have done better there, but it's all, how am I showing up? That's all I have control over beyond the session and our time together. Like, they can do whatever they're going to do. And I can't control that. But coaches get so hung up and invested. Oh, the client had the, and a lot of times it's like, how much of it was me? How much, I don't know. All I can control is what I am doing and how I'm showing up in the session.
Yeah. And that is, I think, sort of a developmental journey of letting go of attachment to outcome. And I, you know, and this comes up also in conversations, is this idea of, you know, people are paying me, so the value I have to bring as a result of that is this X outcome. And yeah. I think it's, you know, it's sort of a reflection on what you just said, which is all I can control is how I hold the space. I cannot control what meaning you make from yourself and what actions you'll ultimately determine to take to explore, play with, do something, not do something, whatever that is that's important to you. And so to your point, I mean, where is that line on responsibility? And if the line is I'm responsible for this and you're responsible for that, then how do we be okay with that?
Yeah. Which is at the root, I think, of MCC coaching is I fully trust the client to do what they need to do for themselves, to take care of themselves, to come up with their own answers and insights. And my commitment has to be, I have to show up 100% in the coaching session. I have to be 100% present. I have to be continually sharpening my, and it goes back to doing my own work, but also sharpening my own coaching skills as well. And to self-reflect afterwards and say like, okay, could I have done something better there? Is there a way that I'm challenging myself to show up fully? And like, could I have asked a better question? Could I have said that more succinctly? Could I have said something that maybe I held back on saying, whatever it may be, to have that assessment? And that's where I do have kind of agency and control, over that. And that is my part to do. And if I'm not doing that and the client's not getting a result, then I have to say, okay, I could have done better there because I didn't bring everything that I could have brought.
How do you self-reflect?
I mean, I think I'm often in a state of self-reflection in the sense of I think I often am observing myself in many ways of like how I am in different situations and interactions with people. So I think it's just an ongoing process of saying like, okay, what did I do well? What could I have done better? And just asking myself those questions, much in that kind of inner coach of like, okay, how could I have said that differently? What might have landed better? What was I picking up on? What did I miss? And observing, I think there's that two-way thing of, I think it comes back to, emotional intelligence, there's self-awareness and other awareness, but also looking at, okay, how is the client responding or not responding? Like, was maybe there a point where they seemed a little bit more, maybe they weren't being heard fully, or like there was a way I was approaching it that just didn't quite land. And am I kind of reading the room and reading the signals? And so it's I think a lot of observation around what's happening and what the outcomes are, and then seeing, okay, what was my part in that, or what could my part have been? So I think there's a level in that reflection of, I don't necessarily know that I have time where I'm like sitting down and like, okay, I'm going, I think it's more things, after a coaching session, I'm just, will innately, even if I'm going to do something else, I'll be kind of thinking back to it and kind of replaying it in my mind and seeing how it went. And
one of the things that I started playing with, this was quite a few years ago. I had gone to another conference and saw a different therapist talking about sort of, what was he talking about specifically? It was really about having really good documentation on sort of the value of what you're offering. And one of the things that he had recommended was he had like a little worksheet, and after every client saw him, they would fill out this little worksheet, and it was just a simple little worksheet. And so I thought, I'm going to do that with my own work. And so I adopted that after coaching sessions, people grade sort of like, did you feel heard? Did you not feel heard? What was it, what could I have done better? What did I do well? Like, and what do you need that's different? And I sort of implemented that to your point about self-reflection, because I think sometimes, and I don't know if this has been your experience, but there are times where I'm like, this is going great. And the other person's like, not so good. And so like sometimes reading the room, I'm reading maybe my own energy and not theirs. Or just something didn't land well, but they're still in the, it's okay phase until it isn't a little bit later, like they thought about it and then it isn't. And it's just been such an interesting opportunity to get feedback in real time from my clients in a way that's really safe for them, but also to hear them when they're not just on the spot, like, so was it good for you?
right. Yes.
Kind of, oh, yes. Comment. It was great.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. A lot of times, when you ask that cold, people are just going to, of course it was great. Oh, yeah. Partners are going to say like, oh, yeah, well, you really sucked, when you did that thing.
But I need a break for that.
Yeah, exactly. But I think also, and actually, as I'm thinking, kind of unpacking your question as well, I think doing group mentoring has also been a way for me to get really good feedback. And actually, mentoring has just been a great way to learn, period, as a coach. But often in those situations, you know, there is life coaching in the mentoring, and sometimes other people do it. Sometimes I will do it. Sometimes it's a tag team effort. But I find through that too, I also get a lot, as do the other people in the group. Get a lot of really good feedback. And so that has also been a really good way for me to sharpen. And again, here, because then to your point, you know, we already know, like, we're going to be debriefing. People already know they're going to share feedback. And so it's the expectation that you will. And so therefore, you know, I will hear things that, you know, oh yeah, well, when you did this, that was really helpful for me. And, you know, when you did that, yeah, that kind of took me, you know, kind of got me up into my head a little bit. And I was, you know, kind of took me out of, you know, where I was at. So I think group mentoring has been also a way of maybe getting the other reflection versus the self-reflection.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a balance of all of it. Right. I try and remind people, just because you've gotten feedback doesn't also mean you have to go, oh, this is the absolute 100% truth for me either.
Right.
You get to discern the feedback that fits or doesn't, and how you want to use the feedback and what you want to do or not do differently. It's completely going back to your earlier, you know, observation. You're in control of you. You get to decide. And so I think there's also a piece around, you know, how we work with the feedback that we're given too. It doesn't mean I must go, yes, you're so right, I must change that. It can be, oh, I appreciate that. No.
Well, I think that goes back to the part about doing your own work again, because it's like, if you haven't, like, you're going to get defensive when you hear feedback, or you're going to maybe take on more than you should. Or I think, like, the more you can get your own stuff out of the way, the more you can hear feedback, take it for what it is, and and really know what you know, how you're going to work with it. Like, okay, yeah, that makes sense, and yeah, I could kind of see this, and yeah, maybe that part doesn't quite resonate, or maybe, you know, whatever it may be. I think that gives us the tools to be able to process the feedback in a way that is going to be useful for us to actually do something with.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, this has been an experience that I've had recently where I get excited about feedback. I've gotten so much feedback in my life at this point that I'm just sort of like, whatever, just bring it on. And I get negative feedback as well as positive feedback. And I'm like, great, you know, just all information. I'm not attached to it one way or the other. But I notice, I think for myself, that sometimes as I'm like in a mentoring situation, I'm excited about all the options and possibilities and different directions we might go. And sometimes my the coaches that I'm working with are not as excited about the number of options and directions and choice points that I'm like bringing up. And I've really decided, you know, I'm like, I'm just trying to be very transparent with people also, because I think I'm just in a very different place around feedback at this point, you know, and I think that observation seems to, I think, be really important, because I think to your point, if somebody feels blown out of the water in some way, that's not the point, right? Like, that's not useful. I don't want to shut somebody's brain down.
Right. And I think there's a lot too, just in terms of kind of the art of delivering feedback as well. And I think that, and I think this applies, to be honest, I think it's also applicable in a coaching session where coaches are afraid to say certain things. They're afraid of how the client's going to take it. And I think there's, you know, it is being able to also deliver the feedback in a way that's useful, for the person to hear and get. And I think one of the ways that I found that it's most effective, and again, I'm going to come back to the same thing of like doing your work, because to me, one of the key drivers between whether someone can hear feedback well or not, and it's not absolute, but it's how the person delivers it in their terms of their attachment to the feedback. So if I have any emotional charge, and when I'm giving someone feedback, if I am judging them, if I have an issue with them, if I'm feeling triggered by them, whatever it may be, they're going to pick up on it. I don't care how subtle it is. If you can deliver it in a way that's just completely neutral and objective, and like, hey, you know, I'm one thing that's come, and you really have no attachment at all, or even to them getting the feedback or liking it, and you can just say it, that to me is the biggest determinant of how someone will take it. And that's, that takes time and practice to do, to kind of get it to that point. And yeah, there's certain people, like, you know, for example, it's a lot harder for me to do that with my wife than it is with, you know, someone at work, because there's so much more emotionally at stake, you know? And it's being able to kind of get to that point of like, I'm seeing this and I'm offering it to you and I have no attachment and I'm not judging and like, without having to say all that, but just energetically, it's the energy of, here you go, do what you want with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I absolutely agree. And I mean, intent and impact are two very different things also. And sure, so you own the impact if it happens. And also, as a person getting feedback, you are a choice to accept it or not, or to control, alt, delete, right?
and that to me is one of the places where we can be powerful in our coaching, is that, I mean, a lot of things we're offering questions, we're offering direct observations, we're offering all these things in the session. And again, to be able to do it from a place of like, maybe this will land with you, maybe it won't, maybe you'll take some totally different meaning than how I didn't even think, which happens
also all the time.
And so it's like, here, I'm just offering it. And I think that's where, again, coaches are afraid to say it. Like, they have an intuitive sense about something. They have an insight into the client. And one of the things in the mentor, when I'm mentoring people, is like, okay, like, cause they'll be thinking and trying to come up with these great questions and all this stuff. It's like, just what's your innate response? Like, you're listening to this person talk. Just what's coming up for you? What's something that's like, how are you seeing this? And they'd say, well, I'm noticing blah, 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 blah. And then, and I'm like, and then just like, just say that and then ask them, okay, what comes up for you hearing me? And the client's often like, that's it. Like they can kind of get to it, because we're just being direct and just sharing what's there without that attachment.
It's that transparency piece. And it's also really that piece about reflecting something, kind of weird, the instrument, right? Reflecting something, but then turning it back to the client to make like, is this even useful? And it's okay. Yeah. They're like, yeah, no, that's not me. That really is you, David. But then what else is showing up for you? And something may have gotten triggered. But I also find, based kind of on what you're talking about, very rarely do I have like my throat feels tight, or my shoulders feel tight, or my stomach is sort of doing something where I'm feeling kind of bobbleheaded, without it being something that's happening in the space between us. Mm-hmm. And so I love that you're really supporting coaches to learn to listen to their own instrument of themselves, offer the observation without attachment, and then find out for the client what shows up, because I think you're absolutely 100% right. You know, we had another interview last season, and the coach talked about, none of us are good at reading our own labels. And I think it's an example of that, right? Like, so if I hear something or something shows up for me, if I reflect it back to you, but leave it very open, it's a way of reading your label that maybe you've never read before, and you can make what you will with it. Like, oh, I didn't know that I had, you know, artificial sweetener over here or whatever. You
know? Right. Right. And I think that's one of the big things, going back to me, the like real intention of coaching is about awareness. It's, I think the reason we want coaching and the reason why coaching is helpful is because it helps us see things in ourselves that we otherwise can't see. It helps us reveal our blind spots and kind of pull back the curtains. We're just not capable. And I like to use the example when I'm like explaining coaching to people, is like, okay, like, could you tell me with 100% certainty that you have nothing stuck between your teeth right now? And it's like, unless someone just flossed or did something like that, there's always the chance it could be there. Okay. But it's easier if you just ask someone, say, hey, do I have something stuck between my teeth? Like, they can see it. You can't. And so, and to me, that's kind of like a parallel with coaching. It's like, there's all these things. And I mean, and that's a simple, like, that's a tangible thing that you could see. Imagine all the things about ourselves we can't see in a given moment, especially in relationship to what we want. And that's the purpose of the coach, is to help shine the light on those areas that we can't see, pull back the curtains, whatever it is. And so everything we do is an offering and an invitation for the client to kind of, okay, shine the flashlight over here, open this cabinet over there, see what's inside. And maybe there's nothing, maybe there's something, maybe you looking there will make you think of something else that you didn't look in, and who knows where it'll go. But it's kind of that mystery of like, but that's our job as coaches. Like, we're, and if, And if we're holding back and we're not saying certain things or we're not following it, then we're not really offering enough to the client for them to really dig into. If, especially if it's kind of like simple, superficial questions, or it's not responsive to what they're talking about, or we're holding back on like something of like, okay, the client's doing this, but can I really call them on that? It's like, calling on isn't, but that's often, I think, how people think about it. I'm calling them. And right there, you're setting up that energy that like, okay, now when you say something, if you're thinking you're calling them on it, now you're probably going to say it in a way that's going to, versus like, here's just something that's the client I see is really getting in their way.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So first question, do I have anything in my teeth?
You don't, do I?
No, you don't either. Okay. So we're good. Okay. And then, but I think there's also too, what you're talking about, this idea of, if I say like, I'm calling you on something, that kind of that energy that goes into calling people on it. If we were to be a bit more gentle, what would that, like, I mean, how does that then show up for a coach? And I think it's probably different for any coach. So I'm not like, I mean, I don't think we can extrapolate out to all coaches would end up being more empathetic like X. But like, how do you notice that shift from I'm calling them the client on something, or I'm calling the coach, mentor, coach, client on something, versus how you actually do share that with a little more, I don't know, grace and compassion?
Yeah. So I think a few things. I think one is, again, just being in the place of non-attachment. I'm here to serve them. Like they can do whatever they want with what I have. I'm just here to show up. So one, letting go of my own agenda and just realizing whatever, they can do whatever they want with whatever I'm going to say. And I could be totally wrong and they could think whatever, I'm okay with that because I'm here to support them. So I think it starts with that clear intention. And then I think, one of the keys when I'm mentoring is using behaviorally specific language. So taking any judgmental label or term out of what you're saying. And I think the more you practice that, the more you stop judging anyway. Like you start to get more, it's like, okay, this person isn't, instead of like that person's being rude, it's, oh, that person didn't smile at me when I said hello to them. Like that's a behaviorally specific observation of something someone did. My interpretation is that they're being rude. Who knows why they didn't smile at me? All I know is they didn't smile at me.
They had stuff in their teeth.
Yeah. They were feeling self-conscious. And so I think it's just being able to kind of point out some of the things that it's really pointing out the observation. Like, you know, I notice as you're saying you're not angry, but I notice as you're talking that your face is tightening up, that your voice is starting to raise, and that you're saying things like, that person is really irritating me, but I know they're a good person. And so, it's just, you know, pointing out things that are just kind of there. And then again, I'm just the mirror at that point. I'm literally reflecting their behaviors back to them. And then they can interpret what they want. And they'll be like, oh, I didn't realize I was tightening my face. Or, oh, yeah, I guess I am kind of saying, like, on one hand, I'm saying I'm not angry. But on the other hand, I'm saying this other thing or whatever it may be. Yeah, exactly. So
not angry.
So, and again, but I think it's also important in that of like, I wouldn't say, oh, you seem angry because again, now I'm also, unless the client, and I say this all the time, like, don't project an emotion. Ask and if you wonder if there is an emotion, then ask the client, like, I'm sensing there could be anger here and I'm noticing this. What are you noticing? And then let them versus like impose any emotion, take the emotion out of it, unless they say the emotion explicitly or something close enough that it's like, okay, they're not directly saying they're angry, but they're saying everything else that's basically, you know, to that. So you have to.
And even then, I think we can invite the client to name it for themselves. Cause I don't know about you, but I hate it when people tell me how I'm feeling.
Totally.
Like, even if they're right, it's almost even worse if they are right and I am angry. To tell me I'm angry, I'm like, I used to ask my husband, because he has this face that looks like he's like really serious. And I'd be like, are you mad? And he'd be like, should I be? And I would be like, no.
I will if you keep asking me that. I will.
That's right. I can get there if you like. Hilarious.
Yeah.
So I want to go back to your original coach training, because you mentioned you took this training with your mom. And the other day when we had met up outside of the podcast, I had this like, hey, who's your mom? And you know, and it was sort of a funny little thing, but you mentioned that you guys had gone to coach training together. You know, would you mind sharing a little bit of your story of origin?
Yeah, I mean, so my mom is Marion Franklin, and she's also an MCC. As far as I know, we may be the only like familial MCCs, or I'm sure mother and son. There's probably not their mother and
there's
son.
There's a mother daughter I know for sure.
There's a mother daughter. Okay, cool. Cool. So we both, like I said, we both were, took the training at the same time. She definitely had much more of a direct kind of path to coaching, in that like within a few years, she really committed, like, I'm going to be a coach and I'm going to focus on that and start my own practice and do all. And, you know, and that turned into her having a coach training program of her own and, you know, writing her book and all that stuff. So she kind of went down that path. Whereas for me, it was much more, again, like that systemic, holistic path of I love doing coaching, but I also love doing training and development. I also love consulting. I also love process improvement. I love systems thinking and systems theory. I love organizational development. So, I mean, there were all these other things that emerged to kind of weave themselves in with the coaching. And so my path became much more, you know, like all these other.
You were on the winding journey.
Yeah. But still with everything connecting to each other, it was still kind of a core theme of transformation and improvement and growth. And so, so it's funny because, you know, well, one, obviously, like her being my mom, people are like, oh, like it must have been so cool to have her, like, you know, be training and mentoring you. It's like, well, that's
not exactly how it worked.
We did start at the same time. I was just pretty young considering. And it's funny because for the most part, we actually don't even talk about coaching very much.
Really? I mean,
yeah, we do once in a while, and there's certain things. And, you know, when she, when she was working on her book, like I helped a lot in terms of, I mean, she had the content, but in terms of like the format, like the actual like writing and how to put it together and all that, like I worked with her a lot around that. But I definitely felt like reading her book, it was like, I definitely learned things. I was like, oh, this is really cool. Like I hadn't, you know, there were things in there that, and I tell people like, I don't care how long you've been coaching, read the book. Like I've been around her and I learned stuff, you know, from working on her book with her. But but for the most part, we don't really talk about coaching very much. And I do lead one of the mentor groups through her school, and I'm the director of education for her coach training program. But like I said, aside from even some like business logistics and stuff like that, we don't really talk about coaching a whole lot.
Well, it's family too. So you can talk about things like how the grandkids are doing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. We have plenty of other things to talk about. So it's kind of funny though, how it worked out. I think like on the outside, there's a lot of assumptions people can make about like, oh, you must be totally, you know, talking coaching all the time. And it's like, well, so yeah, but there's certain things that are maybe different than you'd expect.
Yeah. Well, and I really love also the sense of, you know, I've known my mom my whole life, and yet I read her book and I learned something from it. And I really think that's important, because I think there are a lot of books that I have read more than once in my life, because each time I listen to them, I do a lot of audiobooks. Each time I listen to them, I hear them in a new way and I get a different vantage or lens with which to explore a new idea that maybe I didn't have the first time I went through it. So I love that idea of, you know, I may be a master certified coach, but that doesn't mean that I don't still have stuff to learn. And I can also learn it by rereading a book from a person I know intimately well. Right. And, and that's, I just really think that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, go ahead, David.
Yeah. I mean, I still go back and we'll pick up her book and kind of skim through it and like, you know, read parts of it and whatnot, because I think there's a lot of good stuff in there that for me is helpful. And I think even the way it is, we can kind of turn to a page and read a little bit. And it's, I find it good for me again, as part of kind of that polishing and sharpening of ways to stand up. But to your point, I mean, I think there's always stuff to learn and always room to grow and room for improvement, room to get better. And I think if you don't have that mindset as a coach, you're kind of stuck. And I wouldn't want to work with a coach who didn't have that mindset.
Yeah. Struck by that. I'm struck when I meet people and they're like, nope, I'm perfect the way that I am. And I like that attitude, like in general, like, yes, you are technically perfect just the way you are. And right. Life is about growth and development. I think there's, I don't know, maybe it's just because of getting older, but that idea of I appreciate, I know less now than I did when I was like a teenager, because I was so certain of my certitudes at that point.
Right. I think there's a both end too. Cause I think one of the things for me that I do appreciate it. Cause I think for me, my personal growth journey in the beginning was maybe more like self-flagellating and kind of like, I need to fix myself and and so it was almost too much the other way. And I think now what I am appreciating, and it's creating a lot more peace for me, is there's some things about myself that I am going to accept. And it's like, I'm not going to work on that anymore. Maybe I am just, there's certain things and I'm okay with that. Like, I'm not going to be perfect. And yet there's all of course things that I do want to improve on. And, I see in terms of, aspects of how I parent or aspects of how I am, as a partner or whatever, mm-hmm. like there's definitely a way. It's kind of knowing what to focus on and what's important, and things that where it's like, I don't have to be a perfectionist in myself, and I can give grace of yep, that's in those areas. That is just how I am. And I'm okay with that. And you may not like it and you may not like me, but it's not really harming anyone. And it's more, maybe it's irritating to someone, but whatever. It's not causing harm.
Right. And I think again, right. Like, we're a choice. There are certain things about each of us that is, somebody's going to be annoyed by us somewhere.
Exactly. Yeah, there's always going to be someone who doesn't like, you could take the best selling book of all time, the greatest movie, whatever it is.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Someone hates it somewhere.
Exactly. So it's there's, you can't please everyone. So
no. And yeah. I think there's such freedom in giving up that idea that you will be everything to everybody.
Totally.
It's just such freedom
That's been a big one for me to kind of get past, is I can't know everything, and I can't be, it's like just that, I think that acceptance of and it is the, I think maybe to your point, that kind of paradox of both that kind of full acceptance, but also desire to learn and grow, and desire, I can't be all things to everyone, but I can, but yet I can also be as much as I can be.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it's just a bias of mine, which is, lifelong learning, mm-hmm. but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to change. But I think change comes just through the being curious about stuff and going, oh, that's interesting. That worked a little better. Or that's kind of funny. Let me try that and see how that I play with that. Right. And I do think it is interesting when there's our personal selves. And I am who I am, who I am. And then there's our professional selves. And when we go, I am at the pinnacle and no more growth will happen because I'm doing it perfectly. That's a place where I'm like, interesting.
Exactly. I mean, and it's like, there's just always so much more to learn. I mean, even from, as an example, I'm really curious. So I definitely appreciate metaphor and coaching, and it's something that I think is extremely powerful, and it's something that I really try to leverage. But obviously, just in being more connected to you and hearing about you through other colleagues of mine, and knowing just your work with metaphors, I'm excited to go deeper into that. There's an opportunity to grow in that area. It doesn't mean that I don't know what I'm doing or don't know, but there's more. Like I'm sure I could be better at them. I'm sure there's ways I could be even more effective.
So could I. And yeah. I wrote a book about it.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's like curiosity of like, oh, there's more here to kind of learn and unpack and get better at.
Yeah. And I just think that's about, it's what you do with it. I don't know, but that we stay curious, I guess, is the thing that I'm taking from this part of our conversation. So I'm just, this is sort of a kind of question that I really love asking at the end of the conversation. If you were to recognize or recommend rather, not recognize, you can recognize them also, but recommend like a thought leader or a book besides yours and your mom's and mine, but somebody else, is there anybody who's really been a pivotal part of how you think about the world and impacted you in a way that has improved your coaching?
I mean, I think there's so many in so many different ways that it's like, and I think about, it's hard to even separate it from coaching. I would say, one book that I found really powerful, and I guess this kind of touches on the personal growth element, is this book called The Presence Process. It's not specifically about coaching. It's actually about, it's about presence. And so essentially what I love about that book is that, the author has done the work. You can feel it. I mean, you literally, for me reading that book, I feel it. And it's almost to the point when you're reading the book, for me, there's almost like not even a wasted word. Like almost every sentence, you could take almost every sentence he writes and there's something in it that has weight and meaning. But the most important thing is that it's an experiential practice. So when he says the presence process, he's like, I'm saying a bunch of stuff, but the only thing that matters is you doing this process that he outlines in the book. And it is very much about a regular daily practice in presence, and he walks you through the specific steps, you know, to take. So it's that combination of like these insights that are accompanying a really simple, powerful, deep practice. That's not it's not fluffy. It's not light. It's not a distraction. I've done a lot of meditation as well, and Vipassana meditation. It's actually, there's a lot of similarities between his approach and Vipassana meditation. But it's in a way that's, you know, sometimes people struggle with Vipassana meditation. It can be a little more abstract, even though it's not. It actually, I think, is also a very simple practice. But anyway, the way he writes and talks about his practice in presence, I think has helped me, again, to my point, like be able to show up more fully as a coach.
Yeah. So this made me think of the one thing that I said we would come back to that I didn't come back to. Identifying birds through sound.
Yeah.
And it almost feels like this mindfulness and presence might be a part of that. And I'd love to just sort of like, what are you doing, man?
Well, it's also, it's funny because when you said like kind of an influence or whatever, I was mentored by a guy named John Young, who has a school called the Wilderness Awareness School. And he was mentored by a guy, Tom Brown. So my undergrad was in natural history from an indigenous perspective. And so Tom Brown he wrote a series of books based on, I think there's some debate over the validity, but in his books, he talks about being mentored by an Apache elder who taught him all these ways of like, you know, surviving in the wilderness with, you know, being able to walk out and survive and doing all these, you know, tracking animals, you know, down to like, okay, the animal like had to go to the bathroom right here, you know, before they went, like the animal was scared here, whatever it may be. And so then John Young was his student. I'd mentored with him. And I think it's ultimately about systems thinking, actually. And that does very much tie in with coaching because you have to be seeing the whole system. And so birding by ear is very much systemic. It's about recognizing that birds vocalize for different reasons. And when you can start to understand why a bird is vocalizing, you can start to piece things together as to what's happening. So simple example of a common bird that we all have, because it's in every state,
common.
At least in the U.S. If you live in the U.S., the what's now called the spotted towhee, but used to be called the rufous-sided towhee, which I much prefer saying, because it's a cool sounding name. But anyway, like Rufus Adetowi has different sounds it will make. And some of it, you know, one of them is an alarm sound, which is the one that can really tell you a lot about what's happening. And you'll see a Rufus Adetowi, when it gets threatened, it will all of a sudden it'll make a certain type of sound, and it will move up a certain level. Towies never go above maybe 20 feet or so. They only go to a certain height, but they will go to the height that will get them out of range of whatever predator is nearby. So if they go lower, it's more likely to be a cat. If they go a little bit higher, it's more likely to be something that can jump or climb higher, depending on where they are. And so There's things you start to piece together, like, oh, the bird's making the sound, it's moving to this height, or, you know, when it normally would be comfortable here, but now it's moving here. And it's also, you know, it's fluttering its tail feathers a little bit, or It's like bobbing its head a little bit. And so you kind of look at these different things that are happening, and you start to put together the story. Oh, right now there's a predator coming. It's this type of animal because it's only moving this high. And the level of urgency will tell you how much of a threat it is based on how loud or frequently it's making. So anyway, there's all these different elements that you're putting, and that's the same in coaching.
Well, and it's the keen observation and the allowing yourself, allowing your curiosity, like what's going on out there, to be informed by your observation of this creature within its environment. I love that. I hope I'm not sharing any deep secret about where we live, but we both live on Bainbridge Island, and we have the little Dougie squirrels here. And I mean, I've gotten pretty good at Dougie vocalizations as a result of it. And it's the same sort of thing, right? Like, so all of a sudden I know something's around. It might be my dogs, but often it's, you know, something else if my dogs aren't outside. I love that. I just love that observation, that really keen observation of the environment around you. Yeah. And I do think that it really fits in with our ability as coaches to be really in presence with and mindful of what's happening around us and with our clients and in relationship with them.
Very much so. It's actually funny you mentioned the Douglas squirrel, because I wrote an article about the Douglas squirrel, and it was one of the biggest like lesson learners for me about vocalization and sound. And actually, like, they annoy me so much. I part of my practice was actually moving in a way that they couldn't detect me through the woods and being very quiet and like stealthy. So that was, it became this whole thing that, so anyway, it's funny that you mentioned it, because those were definitely big teachers for me.
And they're quite little squirrels too. They're a big personality in a small chipmunk sized squirrel. So David, oh my gosh, it was such a pleasure to spend time with you today. I'm so glad to have you on this final episode of season 3. Just awesome.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me. I know there's a lot more to talk about probably in future conversations and iterations necessary on a podcast. So definitely look forward to more conversations. And
me as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're so welcome. And thank you again. And thank you to the listeners for being. You enjoyed this coaching conversation. If you did, please hit that subscribe button and get the Coaching Studio delivered straight to you each time there's a new show. Please share with people you think might enjoy meeting real coaches and experts making an impact in the world. Get to know them, their journey, and discover what wisdom they would offer you about being a better coach. Music was Frolic by Harrison Amir. Production by yours truly, Lissa DeHart. See you on another episode.